The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. First, I would like to thank the Philadelphia Free Library and all of its staff who made this evening possible. Philadelphia is one of our favorite cities. We love its art, architecture, and great hospitality. It is truly a privilege to be here. As Oscar will be reading tonight from his memoir, A Most Intimate Narrative, I thought I would offer you a personal introduction of him as well. Our story, that is, Oscar's and mine, began in the 1980s when I was working at the Center for Inter-American Relations in New York City as an editor and program director. Oscar had just published his first novel, Our House in the Last World, and he and I became acquainted when I interviewed him for a literature series I had devised entitled Books and Breakfast. I remember thinking, as I asked Oscar a zillion impertinent questions about his novel and Cuban upbringing, this guy is too nice to be real. He was also down to earth and very funny. Following that program, every time he visited my office, he would bring me a rose in true caballero fashion, even though we were just friends. I made some literary observations about him in those early years that hold true to this day, even after all of his achievement, now 28 years later. He was single-mindedly dedicated to his craft in a way that I had never encountered before in anyone else. He was a purist, not interested in following trends in writing, not interested in promoting his name, not interested in being seen or being in the scene. He was a young artist who was following his own singular destiny, however uncertain. Oscar won the Rome Prize in 1985 for Our House in the Last World. Off he went to Italy to write. I would not see him again for a number of years, not until 1989, when he called to tell me that he was publishing his second novel, the title of which I found curious and lyric, The Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love. Something about this novel and all of Oscar's work to me is quintessentially American. American in the truest sense of the word. His literature celebrates individual aspiration and triumph. It honors the working man, the laborer, the common man. His work is a tribute to those who against all odds prevail and even soar in a world of pain and difficulty. His fiction sings of nature and natural grandeur. It rails against injustice in all its guises, and it seeks reverence for goodness, kindness, and decency. It also testifies to the depth of the immigrant experience, whether Latino or otherwise, that which makes the United States of America so future-oriented and vibrant. Whether speaking of incalculable loss and redemption, as in Mr. Ives' Christmas, the bittersweet peace that comes with self-acceptance, as in Dark Dude, the humble surrender to old age, Empress of the Splendid Season, the power of art over evil, a simple Abana melody, or the thrill of sexual pleasure, beautiful Maria of my soul. Oscar Hijuelos places his readers in the thickness of life and encourages us with the wonderment that can come of it. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my privilege to introduce you to my husband, Oscar Hijuelos.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Sí, gracias. Thank you. Thank you all for coming. And you'd think that I would get used to hearing such nice things about me, but I usually don't. But so I was happy for this opportunity. No. Thank you. I guess I'm here to talk about Thoughts Without Cigarettes. It's been, I guess, 9 years or 8 years since I was last in this location to do to present some of my work. So I will begin with just talking about my memoir, Thoughts Without Cigarettes. Part one of Thoughts Without Cigarettes is called When I Was Still Cuban, covering my family's history in Cuba and how my folks came to the States in the 1940s. It also tells the story of how, during a visit to Holguín, Cuba, as a boy of nearly four in the 1950s, I fell deathly ill from a kidney disease that I had always come to think of as my Cuban illness. And the year I spent recovering from it in stateside hospitals, a survival that came with the cost of losing my trust of and therefore facility with Spanish. You went into the hospital speaking only Spanish and came out only speaking English, to quote my mother Magdalena, nevermore. In a way, it is the most novelistic part of the memoir in that these years later, I tried to emulate in the memoir the texture of my first novel, Our House in the Last World, which also tells that same story in somewhat different detail. It's a story, however, that few people seem to know, given that over the past few decades, it's been something I've often had to explain over and over again to people who take a look at me and say, pero no pareces cubano, or they say, you can't possibly be Cuban, or why are you the way you are, and so forth. When you first start out writing, your first books tend to be about, making a statement, answering questions about yourself. And that's what I thought I had done with my first novel. Unfortunately, after I became really well known for the Mambo Kings play Songs of Love, that became known as my first book. So, as a result, I've always had to sort of place myself in terms of what I do and explain myself to practically a generation of new readers every so often. And so I decided to take care of that with Thoughts Without Cigarettes. And along the way to tell the story of my, the struggles that my family went through in Cuba and coming to New York and so forth. It's really a very pro-Latino book, among other things, but it's also pro-American society and New York society. The book is also about my first experiences as a writer. I grew up in a household that neither of my parents were educated in English, nor did circumstances allow them or to educate me in Spanish particularly. I did not grow up with Jane Austen or Charles Dickens or any other famous writers, English language writers. I also did not grow up with Cervantes or you name them, José Martí. I used to hear his name, the famous Cuban poet, but I was not reading García Lorca or, So I kind of came out of a void linguistically and in terms of literature, and it was something that I tried to, I began to overcome somewhat in schools that I went to. I can't say that in public high school I overcame anything in particular, but I do remember reading Walt Whitman for the first time and being very impressed. Later on, I went to City College of New York, and began to slowly untangle myself from the sort of weird web I had linguistically about me, in which I had a lot of, I did a lot of my thinking about my legacy, my background, my heritage, even heard voices. I would think in Spanish, but when I sat down to think intellectually and to write out, you know, whatever I was trying, it would come out in English. So since I didn't think, coming from a poor household, that an uneducated household, that I could possibly be ever good at even writing in English, that became a major challenge. In any event, somehow, while at City College, I drifted towards writing. It started with doing some fairly decent essays about literature. I was really enamored of the works of Joseph Conrad and D.H. Lawrence. And then as I started developing an ear for writing essays, I don't want to be boring, but I sort of drifted off into writing a bit of fiction and plays. And I was the worst writer in the world. I would say very naturalistic in my approach, very very blunt and very basic. But I had the opportunity to work with some wonderful, well-known writers like Susan Sontag and Donald Barthelme, who in their day were very highly regarded. But even when they told me that I was I had some kind of gift, or they thought I had some kind of facility for writing, I had so many, interior conflicts. I never really believed them. I always thought they were being nice. So somehow, I continued writing, and when I graduated from university, I, unlike my other friends who were my colleagues, who went on to teach in universities and put themselves in editorial positions or whatever, I went into the private sector, working for a transit advertising agency, in Manhattan on 40th Street for 9 years after I'd left the university. In that time, I wrote Our House in the Last World, mostly in the evenings and on the weekends. So it can be done. But I'll tell you an anecdote that has nothing to do with anything, certainly not with my memoir, but last night I did a reading in Manhattan, and one of my bosses at this company, whose name was Sid, he was sort of a tyrant, a cross between Mussolini and, you know, any number of horrible people. And I don't know if having a very strong personality keeps you young, but he must be in his 80s now, and he looked great. And he came to my reading, and he was smiling, and he was so proud of me. So even though he thought I was kind of a bum, because I used to read during lunch, and sometimes he'd see me writing, you know, in my lunchtime, he'd say, "What the hell are you doing?" You know, he was very proud of me many years later. But that's a funny thing about writing. You can have unexpected moments of joy. In any event, my job at this advertising agency consisted of taking care of print ads. By that I mean dioramas and car cards and the Long Island Railroad. And I remember that I used to put in advertisements into the Philadelphia train station here. I mean, I gave the work orders for that. And it was a job that was so far removed from writing that I just really never, I'd always wondered whether I would really have a future as a writer. My first novel came out, and, you know, it got very nicely reviewed, some 15 reviews, which I still have in a little box somewhere. And that was about it. I made $4,000 for about 5 or 6 years' work. There's nothing exciting. I rode the subways 5, sometimes 6 days a week to go to this job, moonlighting on Saturdays. But I'm going to read like about a few little excerpts from the memoir, but this is the first one, and it's about what happened one day that was really nice and wonderful to me because of this book that had come out. It's about 1983. 84, I guess, or 83. Still, I had my occasional moment of glory. Not long after my novel, Our House in the Last World, came out, I got a call from the Endicott Bookstore on Columbus Avenue and 81st Street, then one of the great independents in Manhattan. Their manager, a lady named Susan Burkholz, asked me if I wouldn't mind coming by one morning to sign some books. And since I hadn't ever done anything of that nature before, and because it felt like such a professional thing to do, I eagerly accepted. About a week later, leaving my office at about 11, I made my way uptown. When I came inside of the store's two massive front windows, I almost fell over. One of the windows had been stacked with pyramids of Our House in the Last World, along with some copies adorning the wall in a row and nothing else. In that moment, it seemed the fulfillment of a dream. And once inside, I passed the next hour or so by the front counter, euphorically signing my book for the occasional customer, perhaps 20 in all. Not a bad turnout. Afterwards, Miss Burkholz, later an agent best known for representing Latino authors, had me sign some stock copies, and that also left me floating on air. Beaming with accomplishment, I sipped a cup of coffee and, thanking all her employees, I walked out of the store sometime after one, intending to go back to my office. But once I got outside again, I couldn't help feeling overwhelmed by the moment. I was filled with such pride that instead of heading back downtown, I thought, to hell with it, and hailed a taxi instead, giving the driver my mother's 118th Street address. There, I found her in the kitchen, preparing a big pot of lentil soup, one of her favorite meals, as she had become quite a natural health food nut by then, and one bent on preserving herself into eternity. She was just a few short years of 70. Incidentally, her dresser drawers, aside from containing a number of artifacts from her life with my late father, he had passed away when I was 17, and religious pamphlets and rosaries, also brimmed over with Spanish language magazines about health and diets. When I walked in after giving three quick trills of the timbre, the bell, she was surprised and vaguely delighted to see me in the middle of the day. She felt put out, however. My mother hadn't gone around to making herself up or bothered to get dressed. She wore only a robe and seemed as if she had not awakened so long, not long before. And though she told me to sit down and started to putter about the stove, I just said, "Mama, get ready. I want to show you something." "See?" she asked. "See, Mama, a surprise." "Ah, una sorpresa," she replied rather happily. It took her a while. Years later, I'd learned the hard way that her side of the family had arthritic maladies in their blood, and as she moved deliberately but slowly about her bedroom getting dressed, I could hear her giving little cries of, "Ay, yeah, and ay, yeah, ay, yeah." Finally, she had gotten herself together, and escorting her down the street rather impatiently, as I couldn't wait for her to see the window, We reached the corner where I hailed another taxi. By then, because of my mother's rheumatic condition, it was always an operation getting her in and out of any vehicle. But did I care? My moment had arrived. Along the way, no matter how often my mother asked me where we were going and why, the only thing I could say to her, and gleefully so, you know, like a good son, was that she would soon enough see something to make her happy and proud of me. So we hurried downtown, and even though only an hour at most had passed since I'd left that store, by the time we pulled up to the curb, the window had already been changed. Umberto Eco's Name of the Rose, now in the place of honor so briefly given to me. Having no choice but to take her inside, The only thing I could show her were a few of my books on the shelf. The staff seemed embarrassed, as did I, but afterward I took my mother to a pastry shop nearby and bought her some Napoleons, the sort my father, who had worked in the Biltmore Hotel, occasionally brought home when he was still alive. I don't think she had ever had a clue as to how crestfallen I felt, but at least I got some insight right then and there into the nature of that business. Anyway, so thank you. Just a little anecdote. Okay, thank you. So, I worked for this transit company. And what do you do if you work for a transit company? It was called TDI, Winston Network, and they were wonderful. I mean, they were so thrilled that one of their own could become a writer and publish a book. I mean, they were sincerely grateful and happy and proud of me. I could have gotten to work for different agencies writing advertising copy, but I just wanted to stick with what I was doing. And so they responded, particularly after the book came out, with incredible generosity. And some of that generosity entailed helping me put together my own bus ad campaign, which is I got a very, very nice rate on a basic ad for the buses over the racks. A friend of mine who worked for Bristol Myers in the print production company helped me and an art director put together the ad. And so it was prepared. He had it pretty inexpensively printed up downtown. And there used to be all the printing plants in Manhattan, used to be down more or less down in Chambers Street. In any event, one of the benefits of working for such a company had been a humbly financed ad campaign consisting of card cards that went into some of the best bus lines in the city, the number 5 along Riverside Drive and 5th Avenue, and other primo routes. All kinds of folks I fancied seeing my book, Our House, up on the rack and reading its, I thought, because I wrote it, captivating copy. They traveled through, it's about the Santino family, a name I made up, but they traveled through 3 worlds, Cuba, America, and the unknown. For the longest time, I thought such ads would truly make a difference. That is, until I started walking into bookstores like Brentano's and Scribner's and realized that unless you had, that you had to have the books out there on the shelves, which unfortunately, in the case of Our House in the Last World, was not the case. In any event, this brief passage is about what happened with those ads. As for those bus ads, they ran for about 3 months. And though my novel did not fly off the shelves, the enticement that I would produce a similar advertisement and space for a paperback edition induced a fellow named Pat O'Connor at Washington Square Press to spring for a big $2,500 for the paperback rights, half of which I split with the publisher. In exchange, they'd benefit from another ad campaign. I recall riding buses and seeing people looking up and checking out that advertisement, and occasionally I'd run into a friend who'd noticed one, but if it made my name and book known to the public in any way, I wasn't particularly aware of it. Only once did that campaign make a real difference. I think the paperback ads had started to run in the autumn of 1984, and that same October I came down with another one of my horrific flus. Having become the sort of person who would do everything in his power to avoid seeing a doctor because of my childhood illness, I reluctantly decided to drag my sorry self over to St. Luke's emergency room one night, but only after I had started coughing up blood. That scared me. Despite my plague-like symptoms, bad stomach, aching bones, scorched throat, and burning nose, I had managed to continue smoking cool cigarettes until I could barely swallow. Once I got to that waiting room, filled with every variety of junkie, alcoholic, stabbed victim, abused wife, and sick child, as well as a contingent of bloodied and bruised homeless people, I fell into an immediate gloom. Not only did going there again remind me of my childhood visits to that hospital, but I knew that however bad I felt, I'd have to spend half the night waiting. Up by the desk, manned by a Puerto Rican nurse who had the hardened demeanor of someone who had seen every possible permutation of human suffering, her face a mask of indifference, I filled out a medical questionnaire and handed it to her. As she looked it over, her brows rose with interest. Iuelos? Where would I have seen this name before? I didn't connect anything with it and shrugged, but then something hit her. Oh, yeah, I know. I seen it on a bus. The number 11 Amsterdam line. Could that be? Uh-huh. You wrote a book. Is that right? That's me. Well, for God's sake, good for you. And she smiled. Lord, I wish I could do that. Oh, the things I've seen. You wouldn't believe some of the stories I could tell you. Then she took a good long look at me, at my deathly sweaty pallor, my bloodshot eyes, my drooping body, and leaning forward, confided, tell you what, to save you time, I'm going to admit you right away. Okay, honey? You kidding? Why would I kid an author? She pronounced it Arthur, like you. I ended up getting out there about an hour later, and it took me almost a week to get better. And when I did, I dropped a copy of the paperback of Our House off at that ward, inscribing it to that admitting nurse, whose name, it turned out, for all her toughness, was Daisy. Anyway, so, excuse me, it's vodka. Very good. Good for you. Works every time. Really, you know, what happened with me is that I had published this novel that got really pretty remarkable reviews back in the days before the internet and so forth. The New York Times even reviewed it, which growing up in a household where the Times was unknown, for example, and remembering what a leap it was for me to move from vocabulary-wise and syntax-wise up from the New York Daily News to reading the New York Times. It was a tremendous elevation. I felt like I had arrived. On the other hand, I still had my job, kept my job, because I really hadn't made any money or anything or, you know, started teaching somewhere. And I would get depressed. To be honest, I would be really depressed some days. I'd come home writing the number one line, if you know New York City subways, which I imagine a lot of you probably do, on the Broadway line uptown after work, 6 o'clock, you know, rush hour, rainy, horrible outside. I'd be holding on to the central pole that my father, who took the same train home from the same station, 40 Times Square, every day of his life, his work life, I would feel like I was somehow communing with his spirit, and also at the same time, I would wonder if I would ever escape his destiny, which is to just keep working and working and working and working and working. So, little ironically, back then, I didn't know that becoming a novelist was probably worse, but you know, I'd have these moods where things didn't seem right, and I didn't, you know, you sacrifice a lot when you're writing books. And so I'm on my way home, and I come to my mailbox, and I want to get my stuff, and I get my bills. And inside that mailbox, there was a cream-colored envelope, I remember, from an organization that I whose name I'd never seen before. And so I go up to my apartment and I'm preparing to continue on with my life of quiet desperation. I open this letter, and it's from the American Institute of Arts and Letters. It says, "Dear Mr. Higuelos, if you were offered a year's residency in a villa in Rome, a travel allowance, a monthly stipend, and all your meals provided for, if you want to stay in the villa and dine, would you be willing to accept it?" So, needless to say, this was the Rome Prize in Literature. And that little novel, Our House in the Last World, really, in that moment, I was really changed my life in that moment, because 4 or 5 months later, instead of riding subways, after attending a ceremony at the Institute, which was out on 155th Street, right near the Spanish Society of America, where my mother almost fainted because she saw Jacqueline Onassis, who was an editor, standing just a foot from her. I found myself living in Rome, and at this great villa in the Gianicolo, which is a neighborhood on one of the hills, high hills above Trastevere, and it was wonderful. It was just, it could have been made out, I mean, it could have been in the Siberian desert, but never having left New York City, it seemed to be the most enchanting place I'd ever seen. And in fact, Rome is a rather enchanting place. But I soon, once I had arrived there, it was exhilarating for me. And to travel around Europe, which I'd never done before, was something remarkable. But then while I was in the city and hearing a new language, Italian, which I could pretty much understand a lot of the time because of its relationship to Spanish, and even though I wasn't fluent in Spanish, I could always understand Spanish, I found myself feeling probably what my parents were going through when they first came to New York, which is they were in a new world. And that feeling, once again, like being an outsider, kind of inspired me to write with new insights more of this book I had started back in New York about these two brothers, Nestor and Cesar Castillo, who come up from Cuba to New York in the late 1940s. What I'm trying to say is that I suddenly felt myself a stranger in this beautiful, wonderful place. I loved it, and yet I was daunted by it at the same time. In any event, I will pick up with this passage here. It's 1985 in Rome, and this passage comes after I've been reflecting on numerous travels and what, in effect, had become my new life there. Okay, so you must be wondering what all the above has to do with the fact that at the same time, squeezed out here and there, I had been working on my novel about Cesar Castillo, who, as it turned out, had a brother named Nestor. Well, the answer is this: absolutely nothing, except in the sense that such travels and interests set free another part of my heart and soul, which until then had been almost entirely bottled up. And that, in a phrase, helped me with the writing of it. Making the Castillo brothers musicians like my uncle, Pedro — I had an uncle who played with the Javier Cugat Orchestra — I knew they had left Havana in the late 1940s to pursue the mambo scene in New York, and that, as with most immigrants, their first years, while coping with a new language, a strange new environment, prejudice, and an inevitable sense of displacement, as well as an elation, the latter of which I often felt myself in Rome, were difficult. They'd have a moment of triumph, which I could never quite figure out. That is, until one afternoon, on a lusciously fecund spring day, when I was sitting in my studio and trying to decide whether to take a walk down to Trastevere or to remain by my desk searching for a solution. And, you know, I was so in love with the romantic ideal of writers, that of writing and the nobleness of the cause, that I loved it. And when it was even on cold and dreary days, I would type on a little Olivetti or write. I would wear gloves and cut the fingers off and warm my hands by a candle. It seemed like if I'd come down with tuberculosis, I would have been really happy. They'd have a moment of, let me just go back. I'm very digressive, I'm sorry. So they'd have a moment of triumph, which I was trying to figure out one day, and I was very much tempted to walk down to Trastevere. For some reason, just as I was about to leave, I began to recall how, as a kid watching television with my father, we delighted in the I Love Lucy show. And not only because of the comedy and give and take between Desi Arnaz's character of Ricky Ricardo, a Cuban nightclub performer in New York, and his endlessly charming but zany American wife, Lucy, a matchup, incidentally, that I have in the decades since seen duplicated countless times, but because of how familiar it seemed to us whenever Ricky's relatives turned up at his door from Cuba. I'd always wondered about those folks and the lives they had lived, and while I often entertained a notion of writing something about those walk-on characters, it hadn't yet dawned on me that such an idea could be of use to my novel, in my novel about a former Mambo King looking back on his life. And yet, right then and there, in my studio in Rome, it occurred to me that the brothers, fresh from Havana, had once appeared at Ricky's door, and as musicians and singers would perform on the stage of the Tropicana nightclub, as did so many of Ricky's Cuban friends. Of course, as part of their backstory, set in the real world of the novel, he'd have to discover them somehow. And so, at a moment when I still felt greatly tempted to lose myself in the perfumed warmth of a Roman afternoon, I forced myself to type out the following lines. One Tuesday night in 1955, the Cuban band leader and television personality Desi Arnaz walked into the Mambo 9 Club on 58th Street and 8th Avenue to check out the talent. Someone had told him about two Cuban brothers, Cesar and Nestor Castillo, that they were good singers and songwriters who might have some material for Arnaz to use on his show. The song they performed that night is one that Nestor Castillo had written for a love he'd left behind in Cuba, Beautiful Maria of My Soul. In some ways, it was strictly a product of my life in Rome and of my closet religiosity, for the name Maria first came to mind in terms of that novel on the Good Friday evening before Easter of 1986, when I had gone to the Colosseum to watch, among crowds of Romans, Pope John Paul II preside over the procession and ritual known as La Via Crucis, or the Stations of the Cross. Through a sound system that thundered, echoing through the farthest recesses of the ancient center, an Italian cardinal with one of the most resonant and deeply rich voices I'd ever heard began to recite the story of Jesus' passion and death. Now and then the name Maria would burst through the narrative. Allora, Maria, la donna di Gerusalemme, Gesù, il figlio di Maria, Cristo Gesù, nato dalla Vergine Maria, Santa Maria, Vergine del Silenzio e di Misteriosa Pace,
Il cuore in piena per la empatia con la tua morte e il tacito dolore di Maria. Maria, right?
All the while enchanting me in such a manner that I allowed that name to roll over and over again in my mind, until at a certain moment, long after I'd left that wonderful processional, in the middle of the night, I shot up in bed, not from any bad dreams, but from something that came to me as if out of the Roman / Havana. And I say that because somehow Rome reminded me of Havana air. A simple line, La Bella Maria de mi alma, which I just had to scribble down, lest I forget that subconscious rumination. Beautiful Maria of my soul came to me. Anyway, thank you. And you know, when I was writing that passage about the brothers, who would have known that Antonio Banderas would be playing one of the brothers one day? It was like one of those miracles. I don't know. Okay, I tried, but okay, no. Well, I see what you're saying about the ledge. Okay, thank you.
So I think that you, most of you know how this works. Raise your hand. We'll get a mic to you. Please wait for the mic. Who would like to start us off with a question for our Arthur? The lady in blue all the way in the back there.
The Arthur guy.
Hi, my name is Lisa Parlade, and my question is regarding your most recent novel, or barring this novel, The Beautiful Maria of My Soul. And I'm wondering if that came out of the critique that you received from Mambo Kings, or more of an internal feeling of, you know, this novel is not yet finished. We need to hear from Maria, and I want to hear your thoughts on that. Thank you.
Interesting question. Did my follow-up 20 years later on Mambo King's Beautiful Maria of My Soul come about as organically from the Mambo Kings or from another notion? I actually always knew what happened with what really happened between Maria and Nestor, but I never wrote it. And the Mambo Kings was getting too long, and also the points of view in that book were sort of selective. But what I think happened is that I had been thinking about the story of the Mambo Kings as a theatrical piece, and my original notion from Maria kept coming back to me, which is that if you know any strong-minded Latinas, or for that matter, any strong-minded people at all, what would you do if you lost your love and you were sitting around and walking down the street in Havana one day and you heard them singing a song about you on the radio and it was a hit? And so it seemed logical to me that, and very emotionally plausible, that she would decide to go up to find her love and try to bring him back to Cuba. And so that was one of the notions behind the novel. But really, I wanted to do some playful things with the whole concept of, you know, what is a book and what is a narrative and what is real. So a good part of the novel, Maria, Beautiful Maria, existed in the real world in a way that other parts in the Mambo Kings kind of never did, never really did. But they overlap in Maria, and to the point where I'm not really sure which is the invented story. So I know I didn't answer your question, but I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. I was always digressing.
Another couple questions. Yes. I'll go to Ed in the fourth row here. Fifth row.
Hi, thanks for coming to Philadelphia.
Well, thank you, Ron.
I'm a sucker for sadness, whether it be great sad country song or a bolero, uh-huh. And your prose is some of the most beautiful sadness in art, I think. Where does that come from, if it's not too personal?
Oh, it's called depression. Deprimido, no, I don't know what it is. It's, I don't know, it's
It's a natural gift. I don't know. I don't mean to make fun of it. I don't know. There's so much beautiful stuff comes out of strong, you know, I think more beautiful art has come out of sadder emotions than you know, happy. I know, for example, that I was always fascinated. If you listen to old-time Argentine tangos, and you actually listen to the lyrics, I mean, they're really about these tremendously tormented, sad stories, you know. The same thing is true with boleros. There's, you know, I'll tell you a story. When I was writing Mambo Kings, I made up a song that they perform called Panuelo, which means handkerchief in Spanish, right? And I forget, it was one of the musicians, he takes the idea of the song is that this musician takes this handkerchief, which his you know, love had cried into, and he puts it under his pillow every night, and he dreams about her, right? And I'm thinking, wow, how sad, how melancholic, and what an inventive guy you are, you know? And so I was really proud of myself. And about 2 or 3 years later, I'm in Miami or someplace like that, and I hear in the car, and then the radio comes a song called Panuelo by some guy who also had a similar idea. But what joined them both is this sort of sadness or this, you know, pattern of emotional, I don't know. I always say, I think I call it tristeza de amor. You know, the sadness of love, which is a theme. But it's probably linked in some ways. It's interesting to me, as I do this reading, I've been noticing that I talk about having been separated from my family, and the year was exactly 1955, more or less. And I find it interesting that in the I Love Lucy, Desi Arnaz business, that 1955 is a crucial moment when Desi Arnaz discovers these two brothers playing in a club, and not to play Freudian, I've always wondered, or I've just realized tonight, I'm wondering if they have some relationship to one another of wanting to discover a new world or not. But in any event, the worlds to me are linked by common emotions. I'm not sure if sadness is right, but I don't know.
There was an idea here.
Did you participate in the movie in any way? And if you didn't,
I'm sorry.
Did you have any play any role in the screenplay or in the movie? And if you didn't, were you pleased?
You mean the Mambo Kings film? There were a couple. I mean, I loved the first part of the movie, the first 25 minutes or so, to be honest, because there's a lot more intimacy in it. There's a very comforting atmosphere, particularly when the brothers show up in New York and they're hanging out in this apartment. I like that. And then the movie from there seems to become more formulaic, which wasn't my idea. But at a certain point, I saw a couple of, you know, I saw a run-through, and even though the movie was about these two brothers, I kind of said, you know, I don't think they're really talking to each other so much. So I kind of uncredited, but I kind of wrote some scenes for it. And one of them, if you remember the film, they're in a photo booth talking and carrying on. And that just started out with some jotted down notes. But in general, I enjoyed the process, and I love seeing actors working. And I only spent about a week or so around the movie production, but it happened, looking back now, it happened amazingly quickly, given how long some things take. I don't know.
A few more questions right here in the fourth row.
Thank you, by the way. Nice question. Thank you.
I'm just curious, wondering if you visit Cuba or you have a relationship with that place.
I could have for many years. I mean, after my success with the Mambo Kings, the Minister of Culture in Cuba, headed by someone named Abel Prieto, I believe his name is, invited me to visit the Institute of Writers down there, and I really wanted to go. But on one hand, I wanted to go, but on the other hand, I had so many relatives who left because of the revolution. So I don't know what happened. I mean, I became rigid, a little rigid in my thinking because of that, and I've come to since regret it, because I think you have to transcend politics. But if you were raised the way I had been raised, which would, you know, around people with very strong feelings, it was just hard to maneuver. Although I went finally back after 9/11 and to visit an aunt in Havana, one of my father's eight sisters. And her name was Chelo, and she was in her mid-90s. And she lived out in Marianao, which is a neighborhood, you know, a suburb of Havana, along the ocean, and not far from the ocean. And I'm glad I did. But it was kind of, we were talking about sadness before the gentleman asked me that. I mean, there's something also built in that's sad about not being able to go visit your relatives, you know, when you're growing up. And what I've realized, the tragedy, I think, that's just not my own, but for a lot of Cuban Americans, whether they're sons of immigrants like myself or, you know, the children, or exile generation, you know, I know a lot of Cubans who came here when they were 2 or 3 years old, and they, you know, and they became very American. The tragedy is that it's never been easy, either in terms of your mindset or, you know, literally in terms of government, you know, the Cold War and all that, to go there. So I think my feelings are more of regret over the circumstance in the first place, you know, the revolution, et cetera. My father supported the revolution and then became disappointed by what happened. Once I had gone, I really enjoyed it, and I felt good, even though they considered me a gringo down there. Can't help it. I really, you know, you just feel... there's nothing you can do. You can't, no matter what happens tomorrow, if Pope John Paul II came back from wherever he is now and became president of Cuba tomorrow and opened all the gates to everyone and said peace and good love, it still wouldn't give back to anyone the years that had been lost, you know? And that's the biggest tragedy. So when you ask me a question like that, it's a good question, but it's not an easy thing to go, because it's just getting a glimpse. Even when you do go there, when you finally go there, it's funny. I hear from Cubans now and then who really want to go back but just can't bring themselves to because of political reasons, and I think that's just very sad.
Gentlemen in back.
Are you all still awake? No.
I'd like to introduce myself. I'm a lifelong resident of Philadelphia, and I've been exposed to all the languages spoken in this city, mm-hmm. including where I'm living right now in Busselton, which is Russian. And to my shock, I found a primer book that I took in an evening course of Philadelphia school, after our school, in Russian, and I did the diktat in Cyrillic. I found that book this past week, and I also had my experiences with... mm-hmm. Espanol, mm-hmm. Puerto Ricanos, and the difference between the call, llame in Spanish and llame in Puerto Rican.
Sir, do you have a specific question? Like
yes.
you must be related to me.
My horn, I wrote for American Creativity Association. It's up on the internet. But my question to you is, I saw you out in Book TV or on the Chicago Readers Book Festival. And you mentioned the title of your book. That's what brought me here tonight, Thoughts Without Cigarettes, mm-hmm. because I have relatives that do a lot of thinking and know a lot of smoking with the thinking. Mm-hmm. How did you come? You said smoking made you nervous.
No, nervous made me smoke.
Being nervous just made you smoke.
Yeah. Look, you know, in a way, the book, if anyone knows a novel by the Italian writer Italo's Fable called Confessions of Zeno, if you know anything about that novel, I mean, it's about a guy who's always trying to give up cigarettes, and every time he's on the verge of giving up cigarettes, some calamity overwhelms his life. So one of the original subtitles I had for the novel was Thoughts Without Cigarettes with Apologies to Italo's Fable, okay? In essence, it was just to help me organize some of the thinking and to wrap my mind around different periods when I smoked and haven't. So, the questions that are asked me in a way I find that very, difficult to answer. The only thing I can say is it seemed like a good idea at the time, and in fact, it gave me points off to which to reflect. Yes, sir. Yeah. No, not at all, not at all. Publishers don't really have ideas for the most part. So, but no, to be serious, it's not a polemic about smoking versus non-smoking. It was just such a fact when I was growing up. As I was telling someone, my father, fumava, and everybody, his friends smoked. The kids on the street, the sparrows in the trees smoked. I mean, everybody smoked. The cockroaches smoked. I mean, it was. It was just everywhere, and when I remember being a kid and my father sending me to the corner to get him a pack of cigarettes, I'm dating myself, but they were 25 cents, a pack. And now in New York, you need to have be a Wall Street broker to buy them. But no, it was really just such a part of the background of my upbringing that it was hard to resist that as a title. Sure.
Sir, you know what? We do need to move on here. Gentlemen, all the way.
Thank you, sir.
There.
I appreciate your questions. Thank you.
Good evening, sir. I wonder if you see any contrast between the Cuban Catholic and the American Catholic and maybe from the general Italian Catholic. Is there any is there anything specific about the Cuban Catholic?
You're asking me about Cuban Catholics. I think I don't know. I was raised with I have these discussions with Miss Carlson here occasionally because she was raised not Catholic but in a Christian faith. So in Protestant religion, you have a blank wall and you have a plain crucifix without an image of anyone hanging on the cross, right? In traditional Catholicism, you have an image of the cross with a man and, an agonized face on it, and you see all the wounds. In Italy, you see the figure on the wall draped in flowers and ladies in shawls and rosaries praying on their knees. And in Cuba, you see the figure with flowers and with gourds and fruit and other saints and ghosts and spirits. I mean, I think I was trying to figure out a theme here, but it didn't work. But and essentially, the Cuban Catholicism I was raised with, it was fundamentally Catholic, but it also had other elements of, I have to say, Spiritism. And I remember being taught very often, there's a Holy Ghost and there's, I remember having a very strong sense of Christ when I was growing up and of being very, on the other hand, being very aware of the notion of spirits and ghosts and things that, is a sort of intangible world. And I don't know if that's another world in spontaneous to our own. I don't know if that's particularly Cuban, but that's the way I was raised. So I can't really comment more, except, I love Catholicism. It may not be good for life, but it's great for art, So, I'm sorry. I'm trying to be serious here, but I have a hard time doing that sometimes.
No, I think we'll leave on that up note. Please.
Okay.
Me
thank
in
you.
Thanking.
Thank you. Thank you, Andy. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.